Guten Tag, everybody. As you can see, my German is improving rapidly. It is day 8 of the Euros. Yeah, I can't believe it's been over a week now. The games are coming thick and fast, and I've just taken the Deutsche Bahn Intercity Express, 50 minutes from Cologne to Düsseldorf, a city I've never been to before. And met at the station by my good friend Oliver Hintz and his TV crew, and they very kindly gave me a ride to the stadium. The Merkurspiel Arena hosted the 2011 Eurovision Song Contest. And for those of you who don't know about the Eurovision Song Contest, well, you're better off not knowing. This stadium, 51,500, although I think they've expanded the capacity. It does have a retractable roof and a heating system, and very popular with concerts. One of the ladies who was in the car with me saw Beyonce here and said it was absolutely amazing, and Coldplay are coming here after the tournament. I'd love to see that concert. Fortuna Düsseldorf are the home team, but they're not the home team today. Today we have Ukraine against Slovakia in Group B. And kind of interesting at the moment, actually. Slovakia with 3 points. Ukraine, they lost their first game, getting thumped. -3 goal difference by Romania. So big game. Slovakia can advance to the knockout stages with a win and possibly even a draw today. So I think we've got the possibilities of a good game on our hands. On the train to Düsseldorf, I got to share a compartment with my good friend Misha Scher. And Misha and I go back quite some ways. He's really well connected in the world of football. Very good friends, actually, with David Dean, who is coming to visit here in Düsseldorf. And I guess they're doing the VIP treatment around Germany for a few days. And Misha and I had a chance to catch up and talk football. It's quite a long interview, so what I'm going to do is I'm going to split it up into two parts. Part one will be today, and then we'll do part two tomorrow. So take a listen in to Misha as we talk the business of football, potential Super Leagues, where to play the next World Cup and Euros, all kinds of things related to the game off the field, but not on it. So enjoy this, and then we'll catch up with some journalists and fans from Slovakia and Ukraine. Misha, you and I have known each other a long time, and I want to take you back to 2008, where you said to me the Super League was an inevitability. We're now at 2024. It hasn't happened yet. How close are we to having a Super League?
I think we're a lot closer than people think. I said at the time, and I didn't say it because I wanted it to happen, but I did say it because I felt that the types of people who were getting involved in football were motivated by different things than what people who were traditionally involved with football. And once you had, and I said at the time, I think once you have enough of them, and we have a lot of them now, you'll have a situation where they'll be looking for ways to create a different type of football and different types of competitions that prioritize financial returns over any sort of traditional football structures which we've become used to, and we're close to that now. How many American owners are there? And I don't say American as a derogatory thing. I say it in the sense that these are people who come from a very, very different background in sport, and they will want to replicate that in football.
So you talk about the American owners, and I think it's almost 50% now in the Premier League. Their business model is not one of promotion and relegation, which is the traditional model of football throughout the world, except for in the United States. Do you think they're ever going to get enough power within the Premier League structure to replicate that model?
It's possible. I mean, we know that all you need is 14 votes in the Premier League to you know, to introduce change. Now, I don't know if that, you know, if that applies to that kind of change. I mean, obviously, that's a fundamental change and it remains to be seen. But I think what is interesting, if we look back to the times that you and I were talking about this, when we spoke about relegation and promotion, your co-host thought it was a ridiculous idea. Fair enough, and I think he's admitted that perhaps I was right. Hosting games overseas was also seen as a diabolical idea. We see that happening all the time now, and it's pretty much accepted by people. So these things don't happen overnight, but they happen. You know, they happen in time. The Super League. What's interesting is, whilst it didn't happen, and the way it was proposed was completely wrong. But I think what's interesting is to see what the courts have ruled, that event a couple of years ago, which said that UEFA have a monopoly power. And I think, you know, if you read between the lines, it sort of opens up what could happen in terms of complete restructure of football as we know it.
So we're on a train right now in Germany where the German model is 51% fans. So the fans have a great deal of input and say into how their clubs are run. In England, that's not the case. There has been a movement, though, recently, and certainly government interest in changing that ownership dynamic. Is that possible in England?
I don't think that's ever going to happen. I just don't, you know, I don't see, even in Germany, this is becoming an issue, right? I mean, I see more of a case of German football moving towards where the Premier League is. And away from sort of what traditional sort of German, traditional German model. It hasn't yet, but I don't see a scenario where the Premier League, which is the most successful league commercially, which is owned by, sovereign states in some cases, or some of the biggest investment groups in the world, where they're going to give up some of the ownership to the fans. That's not going to happen.
So this may be very naive, but without the fans, there is no game. So at some point, there has to be an inflection point, though, between the ownership and the fan groups as to how we're going to move forward, surely? Or is it just going to be a case of these ownership groups are going to say, well, screw you, we're going to do it how we want, and you're going to lump it, or you're going to like it?
No, look, I think they'll engage with the fan groups, and they will find a way to keep them involved. But it's not going to be involvement in a sense of ownership, or at least the degree of ownership that we're talking about, like it is in Germany, where fans own 51%. That's just not going to happen. Maybe there'll be a scenario where fans have some ownership. I see. The more likely scenario is that fans will have some representation, a voice on the board. And I think, again, that's perhaps more about perception of having a voice, of keeping fans involved. But that is the more likely scenario in terms of how fans will be involved in the running of club. They will feel like they have a say in various decisions around rebranding or fan activities around the stadium and so on, but they're not going to have any significant ownership in these football clubs. That's just not realistic.
So you talk about the business side of football, and that's the side of football you're involved with. Are we getting close to the point where football begins to eat itself, though?
I think we're past that point, to be honest with you. I mean, you look at all the debates in recent times, particularly around player care. I mean, at the end of the day, it is about the players. You know, they're not robots, as much as we like to think that they are. And we're asking them to play more games and more competitions, and the demands on them have increased, immensely. We're seeing that in shorter careers and injuries, and everyone who's got a role to play in football wants their part. You know, the club football wants their players, the international game, FIFA will say they only have a small percentage of players, access to players. So, and they're the ones who are, and it's true, they're the ones who are actually investing in the development of the game, right? So, but at the end, there are only so many players. And I think we're, starting to see that in the men's and women's game, where we'll get to a point where, you know, perhaps, and there's already a threat of that, where the players will just say, you know, no more.
Well, that's a great point. So, you know, we're talking about fan power, and fans can vote with their feet, with their pocketbooks. Players are ultimately the reason why we come to the games, and as you just rightly pointed out, they're being incredibly overworked. What is your sense of the player unions, you know, FIFA Pro, etc., and how much power and strength influence do they actually have? Because, you know, there's certainly movement to push back on the FIFA Club World Cup by FIFA Pro saying, listen, our players need a rest. Is there going to be a point where the players do actually come together and unionize in a way that we traditionally think of unions?
It's tough to say, because at the end of the day, players, you know, whilst they do have that in common, they want to be able to, they want to have a voice, and they want to speak to governing bodies, but most of the players are motivated by, they have their selfish motivations as well. Now, in you know, the difficulty with football, unlike American sport, is that you have all players that are all contracted to the same league, right? So, you know, NBA runs basketball. You know, you have NHL or other NFL is, you know, is one entity. So you have all the players speaking to one entity. Whereas when you talk about players coming together, who are they? You know, they're playing in different countries, in different clubs, different national teams. And depending on where you are, the priorities of these players are very different. So the idea that somehow they're going to come together and they're going to speak with one voice on quite complex issues that affect them all very, in a very different way, I think is unlikely.
One thing I've noticed about this year is that maybe it's different because this is our first big tournament post-COVID that's in a traditional football country. But the collective atmosphere around here is very powerful. Very, I don't want to say nationalistic, but there's a certain national pride that's really evident throughout, and you see it from the players as well. Could it be a case that players nationally come together to provide their strength in numbers rather than in their clubs where they are individuals?
Yeah, but when you say, you know, strength in numbers, I mean to who, right? So they can come and they can have, you know, they can have a conversation with their own federation, right? But again, it's, you know, what about, you know, so let's say they decide to boycott a tournament, you know, but if Italy and England and France and other teams don't boycott and they think it's okay, then what do you actually, you know, would you actually achieve? Right, I think it's difficult the way that football is organized, club football across different countries in many instances. Same with international football, you're in tournaments against other teams. I think the motivations are different. Some of them, you know, again, some players who are coming from, you know, more developed football countries like Germany, who play for big clubs like Bayern Munich or Real Madrid, have very different perhaps outlook and priorities and challenges than someone who plays for Turkey or plays in Turkey. So it's a lot more complicated. I don't see how you solve that at the moment just because of the complexity of football ecosystem. But you know, maybe I might be missing something.
Well, you talk about complexity, right? So at the top of the tree is FIFA. FIFA is pretty unpopular organization. That's the sense I get. And they're unpopular due to the fact that perhaps their president, Infantino, is more of a dictator than a uniter. Could we ever get to a point where national associations say, you know what, we're not going to deal with FIFA anymore?
No, I don't think that's going to happen. And to be honest with you, I think that's, you know, I actually think FIFA has evolved. Now people will have different opinions of, you know, of FIFA, and that's, you know, that's their right. But if you think about Gianni Infantino's leadership or reign, right? So he's been reelected, right? So ultimately he answers to the member associations. Now, member associations, from and blocks, I suppose, as we call them, for different blocks, vote for him. He brought a World Cup to the Middle East. He's brought a World Cup to Russia. He's brought a World Cup to places where they haven't been. They've invested more. They're going to make, you have to be able to separate people's, opinions of Johnny, whatever those opinions may be, of fans perhaps, who don't, who are not directly involved with FIFA, and people who he's there to serve, right? And he's there to serve, world football. And it means, amongst other things, taking football to different parts of the world, developing football in different parts of the world, generating, maximizing revenue for football, which can then be invested in different markets. All of that has happened. Those are just facts. And that's why those member associations vote for him, because, if taking the World Cup to certain places, let's say it will go to US, it will generate record revenue. Where do you think all that revenue is going to go? It's going to be reinvested within those member associations. That's all they're, that's what they're looking for, and that's why they're going to vote for him.
Okay, so I'm going to completely push back now. We've seen these tournaments in Qatar. I spoke to many journalists. They said it was incredible, but it was like Disneyland. The COVID impacted Euros were kind of all over the place. You were at Wembley Stadium for some of that as well. The World Cup in Russia. The World Cup in South Africa. These aren't what I would call traditional football countries. Why does football have to be spread around the world? Why can't it come to a Germany, a France, an England where the infrastructure is already in place? Billions aren't wasted on building stadiums. I mean, if we look at the environmental impacts that happen in Qatar, where have the stadiums gone? What is the impact of football in that country? Is it really FIFA's job to spread football around the world? Because football's already around the world. Why can't, and this is being selfish, but why can't it just go to countries that can do it properly? And you talk about the money that's generated. It goes to some of these countries that do not have a football infrastructure, and the money just goes into the president's pockets. I mean, there's so much corruption in some of the lesser countries that have a major impact in how FIFA is constructed. I mean, it's almost like the Senate in America, where you have, every state has two senators. So you have Wyoming that has two people in it, and California is 60 million, and yet they have the same amount of power. And we're giving the same amount of power to, the Cayman Islands as Germany.
Interesting point.
Well, I'm going to leave you with a little bit of a cliffhanger there and play the rest of that interview tomorrow in day 9 of the Euros, because Misha's response is absolutely fascinating. But what I wanted to do now was give you an interview that I had with a Ukrainian journalist prior to the match, Slovakia taking on Ukraine. And it really, really touched my heart, because there's so much going on in Ukraine, as we all know, with the war against Russia, and how much sport and the football team mean to this Ukrainian nation right now. Check it out. And the really cool thing is I caught up with her after the game as well.
My name is Irina Kozyupa. I am a sports journalist of one of the best Ukrainian media we have. It's a website, Tribuna.com Ukraine. We cover in sport, especially football, and like every kind of sport.
What does it mean to the Ukrainian people to be here at the Euros?
It's amazing, it's some fairy tale story. Everybody knows that we have full-scale war, and to qualify for Euro for Ukrainian national team, it's a great achievement already. Of course, we want to have better result, because it's motivate Ukrainian people, it's bring them a little bit of joy and happiness and hope in these difficult, dark times. And the disaster in first game with Romania in Munich, it was really upset for all Ukrainian nation everybody was angry, disappointed. Everything we have in Ukraine, it's not much joy, especially now because we have war, we have a problem with electricity, all the time rocket attack, and on top of that, our team played in such, you know, in such bad way. It was defeat, which we cannot be proud of the defeat. It's shameless defeat, and we're very sorry for that. We show us on Euro on that way, like that our national team have no face. You could lose as a Georgia or other teams, but lose with proud, and we lose with a shame. You know, like it's not about Ukrainians. So at least in two games we have, we want to show that we are not. It's not Ukrainian people. It's not Ukrainian national team. We could better. We could lose, but we could fight on a football pitch. So hope today it will be much more result and the game on the football field.
I just can't believe that it was only 12 years ago that Ukraine was hosting the Euros. Can you put it into words from being the host to now being in a war? I mean, how on earth does that happen?
Recently, I even wrote a text about that Euro that we were co-host with Poland. It was my first Euro as a journalist. I was young, just after university. And it was an amazing story also that our country hosts such a big tournament. It was a lot of work for that tournament. And it was to look at that time, it was amazing time. It was peaceful time. We co-host Euro. A lot of fans came to Ukraine and opened for them Ukraine as a country, as a beautiful country with kind people, with cheap beer, and it was a like perspective that we hope at that time we would be as one of the country, one of the country that really belong to Europe with a good with a. First of all, without war. At that time, I think nobody can imagine that we are in such a difficult political war situation that we don't fight, for example, to host Euro or World Cup, to host Olympic Games, but we fight just to be, as a country, fight for a peace. And it's very upset story, but we remember that Euro as one of the like very warm memories and big event we had in our history.
When I look at Ukrainians right now, you do get so much pleasure from sports, in boxing and in football. It seems like these are the biggest exports and these allow to express themselves.
That's true, because cultural. Maybe not at the same level, but sport is a place where could you show your emotions and to be proud of your sportsmen as they represent the country. And for people, it's really a way to express their emotions. That's why after this first game, Ukrainians was, you know, it was so big wave of hate, of critical comments to the national team and to the players, because people feel like they that the football team, don't prove their hopes. It was too much expectation from the team, too much pressure on them.
In the past, when I've, you know, over the last couple of years, the Ukrainian football team has been very proud, and the players are always, they're wearing the flag, and it seems like they're very to represent their nation in such a positive way. Do you really think it was the pressure that got to them in this first game?
I think it was a lot of pressure. First of all, as a result, because we put on them this pressure, called them the best generation in the history of national team.
Even better than Shevchenko?
Because, you know, at Shevchenko, it was Shevchenko and 10 other players. It was pressure on Shevchenko. Now we don't have such a big star, such a big name in a football like Andriy Shevchenko, but we have 10 very good players. 11 or even 26 very good players, some of them higher level, some of them playing in Europe for Chelsea, for Arsenal. So we ask from them to show this level of football. But something goes wrong, like even a taxi driver yesterday told, I know why your team lost. Why? because they go fast to attack and then come back to defense very slowly. Like, wow, you should be part of the team. So yeah, it was really precious. First of all, it's bad generation. Second, as a team that you represent the country in the wartime, so like, you should fight like, you know, like a soldiers on a football field, and everybody talk about them, about that, and players everything read, and they know that because they also live in they part of the society. They're not separate, even if they playing abroad in other countries. They know the situation that, and they wanted. They also was like after the game said, "We are sorry. We apologize. We will do better."
At this point, Edie became very emotional, so I turned off the recorder. However, I did catch up with her after the game, and she was emotional in a very different way. Check this out. You were crying earlier. Now you're crying again. What does it feel like?
You know, it's happy. You know, it's something like happiness, maybe like that. It's really good emotions, very tired, but at last calm that we like, whoo, why can't we play like this in the first half? Now we will have 6 points and go further. But at least the feelings you're proud of your team, you know, something like, yeah, it's our boys, it's our team.
I'm looking at the players, we're seeing them on the monitor and they're crying as well. This is just incredible.
It's something that gives a whole, for the whole country, something good feelings, some hope, and really a good evening. Despite everything, despite like the war, the problem we have in the country, the challenges, now I think every country is like a little bit happier and proud of our team.
And that, ladies and gentlemen, is what the Euros is all about. Honestly, this tournament just keeps on giving. And there are so many neutral fans that are rooting Ukraine on for the very reasons that Eddie was talking about. And I, for one, are one of their biggest fans, and I hope they go a long way in this tournament. Well, listen, we're out of time. It's been a long episode today. Make sure you come back tomorrow to have part two of Misha Scher and his potential vision of what world football is going to look like. And I will be off to my favorite stadium in the world, the Westfalen in Dortmund. And Turkey are going to take on Portugal. I have goosebumps thinking about it right now. And I know sometimes we put expectations on games and it's always a big disappointment. But I will tell you this, the atmosphere tomorrow night will be electrifying. Speak to you all tomorrow. It's Inside Euro 2024. Bye for now.